question.
So last time...
Can I just say that it's because he gives you something that lasts with you forever? So
that's right. That's right. It's with you for, it's like your father. Your father and your mother, they brought you into the world. Now, they're not constant. It's not an ongoing action, but the fact that they brought you into the world creates a connection between you and them, which is unbreakable forever. And the Gemara says that if you're obligated to honor your father and your mother, who bring you into this world, all the more so your Rebbe, who brings you into Olam Haba. The point is that when you get that, when that connection of Rebbe Talmud is established, if it really was established, then it's forever. It never stops. Okay, so... Yeah, so it hit hard, you know, when I saw the news. It was actually interesting. That morning, I got an email from a family member. I didn't even see the news myself that morning. That, like, you know, they sent me a link to it, and I saw that, you know, before they released any of the names. And for some reason, you know, I mean, Rahman al-Islam, a lot of these things have been happening, I guess, not on such a horrific scale, but a lot of these things have been happening. You know, but this one like really hit hard. When I got to the Beis Medrash, like I couldn't even learn Bichlal. And then later, you know, when someone came over to me and told me that my Rebbe was going to be murdered, it was just like terrible. But okay, we're not here to talk about me, we're here to talk about him. So last time we spoke about his incredible godless in terms of Yediyas HaTaira, Hasmada in learning, I don't know if all of you are here, his Avodas Hashem, etc. And then we barely managed. Oh, we did get into his devotion to his Talmidim, the way he was, you know, he was real with his Talmidim, and despite the fact that he was like so on a very high level, he related to us on our level. And then we just like touched ever so slightly the Indian of Midas Taibis. So I mentioned that once had that mindset where he said to me, "Milcham Shal Tair is no excuse for bad Midas." I wanted to mention something about that, by the way. Were you all here last time? Okay, so last time I mentioned that by my nature I'm a very fiery person, and when I was younger it was even more so, and I would just like immediately, as soon as I would start learning with someone, like within a minute I would be screaming at them. You know, it was just the way that I learned. So my chavrusa at that time, my first year in Torah Moshe, he didn't take so kindly to it, despite the fact that he himself is also a pretty confident person and an intelligent person. And it really bothered him, to the extent that he once told me that when he would tell me an idea, a svara, a way to understand the Gemara, or a rishon, or whatever it was, and I would like pause to think about it, he told me he would be in pachad, waiting to see what my response was going to be. So it bothered him, so I went over to one of the members of the Hanhala of the yeshiva, and I asked him, this is just the way that I learned, but it bothers him. So he told me, he said, "Listen, really you're right, because it's Milchamta Shel Taira. It's the war, it's the battle of Taira." Right? The Gemara says that a Rebbe and a Talmud and a father and a son, they become like enemies while they're in learning, because they're fighting against each other. But then at the end, they love each other. He said, "But if it's bothering your Chavrusa, you should try to tone it down." So I don't know why, but for some reason, I thought to ask Rebbe Tversky also. And he was did not mince words with me, and he said to me, "Milchamta Shel Taira is no excuse for bad midas." That's the way he said it to me. Now, what exactly does that mean? Because if a person is an arrogant person, or if he's an angry person, I don't know if any of you have ever had a chavrusa who's angry or arrogant, right? And that's where it's coming from, that he gets all fiery. He's getting all fiery because he's angry or arrogant or both. So then it makes a lot of sense. You know, don't use Milchamta Shel Taira as your excuse to express your anger and your arrogance. But there definitely are a lot of people who they just get fired up. It's, you know, they're very excitable. As a matter of fact, I once had a maizo where one of the guys came over to me after we had one of these heated discussions in the lunchroom, and a friend of mine came over to me and he said, "You know that they're doing that just to push your buttons, right? You know, they just want to see the show." So, you know, I don't think it was an expression of anger or an expression of arrogance. It's just, I'm a very fiery person. So what did he mean? Bichlal, what did he mean? I think what he meant was that even if you're not doing it as a result of a bad midah, if it's bothering someone else and it's hurting their feelings, that is a bad midah. You are acting in a way which is a bad midah. Okay. And we also told the ice cream story. You weren't here last time? Alright, so I'll mention it again because it's a really good story. So one Purim, he spoke a lot about the idea of Hakaras HaTayv. I'm sure he somehow tied it in. Maybe he got it from Oymer Davar B'Shem Oymer, I don't remember. But he talked a lot about the meaning of Hakaras HaTayv. And then he applied it on the practical level to having Hakaras HaTayv for the Rebbetzin, because she's the one who makes the whole meal, etc. So I understood from him that it's if you are eating in someone else's house, it's not enough to just say thank you. Let's say if you're eating at your Rebbe's house, it's not enough to just say thank you to the Rebbe. You have to say thank you to his wife, right? She was the one who did it, assuming that she was the one who made it. So one time, could be the Shabbos right after, maybe a later Shabbos, we were by him. So we left, little Shabbos. The Rebbe wasn't there, maybe she went to sleep. I guess we ended late or something like that. We got to the bottom, and I said to my friend who was walking with me, I said, oh, we forgot to say thank you to the Rebbe. All right, let's go back upstairs. So we knock on the door. And like every single second, he was learning all the time. He was a super masmid. And Bifrat on Shabbos, his sons said that like he never went to sleep on Shabbos because he was always learning. So he opens the door and he's like, yeah. So I said, we forgot to thank the Rebbe. You know, I just thought it was going to be, that's it. He'll, you know, tell her that we said thank you. So, but he was like, wow, that's amazing. Come inside. He sits us down. He says, I'm going to go get you ice cream. Now, mind you, we both had ice cream at the end. We had dessert already and both of us were stuffed. His Rebbe's in Grademix, now his Almano, Grademix, very good food. But he, and you know, we protested and said, no, Rebbe, we really don't want it. You know, we just wanted to say thank you to Rebbe, and that's it. But he insisted and he went to the kitchen and got us ice cream himself, both of us. And he sat down with us. And then he was like, listen, if you really don't want it, you don't have to eat it. You know, I guess maybe he was worried that we would feel like, so we did eat it, right, even though it was a little bit difficult. But, you know, so I wanted to say two hars about that story. First of all, you just see how important this Titus was to him. You know, that he made such a big deal about it. I mean, we didn't feel like it was such a big deal. Like, you know, okay, came back to say thank you to the Rebbe. It's not, like, such a big deal. But he made a very, very big deal about it. But the front, if you understand that every single second of this person was for Hasmada in learning. I mean, literally every single second like I said last time, measured and treasured. And Bifrat on Shabbos, his youngest son Avram, he said that he once told him, I guess he must have asked him, how come, Tati, you don't sleep on Shabbos? Or at least it didn't look to them like he slept on Shabbos. So he once, you know, he told him, he said, the time on Shabbos is just too precious. I can't use it for sleeping. Okay, let me tell you another ma'isa. I mentioned last time that he was Banin Venechid of the Chernobyl and Tolner dynasty. Technically speaking, he could have been the Tolner Rebbe. Technically speaking, he would never in his life agree to do that. But a lot of the guys, maybe even most of the guys in Teres Maisha, used to call him the Rebbe. Right? You know, a little bit, you know, referring to the fact that he could have been the Rebbe, but also because he was like our Rebbe. You know, people were, you know, kind of like his Hasidim. So it was mostly, you know, a term of chibo, you know, a term of respect. So one time a humorous thing happened. I think it was a Hanukkah mesiva. Well, it was humorous to us. I think it was a Hanukkah mesiva, and he was speaking. He was one of the speakers at the Hanukkah mesiva. So he started talking. I think he was quoting like one of the Hasidic svarim, that there's this concept that when a tzaddik davens in a certain place, so it creates some type of Ruchni's spiritual reality, that now anybody who davens there, it's easier to have kavana. Because a tzaddik makes a roshim. He makes a roshim where he davens. So he said, like, you know, a tzaddik or a rebbe. So when he said, or a rebbe, so people started like to smile and smirk and laugh a little bit because, you know, they, you know, like, he's there. He's the rebbe, right? You know, and he's here, like, so he does that for us. So it was kind of like this, like, you know, nervous type of smiling, like, where it's like, oh, you know, that's it. But he didn't chop, like, because, you know, it didn't dawn on him that that's why, you know, people would be smiling, because we related to him as, like, he's the Rebbe, right? So what he did was, he said, okay, you don't want it from a Hasidish source, so I'll tell you from a Litvish source. And he was like, I'll tell you from an Nefesh HaChaim, you know, from Chaim Volozhiner. At that point, everybody burst out laughing. Came out the entire yeshiva. Why? Because when everybody realized that he just did not understand at all, he thought that what we were thinking is that, oh, you didn't want to hear from a Hasidic source because you're all Litvish Abachim, although not all of us were, right? But it's a Litvish yeshiva, let's put it that way. So I'll tell you from a Litvish source. And it was like so mufka by him, it didn't even occur to him that maybe the reason why they're smiling is because they, you know, they think of me as their other. No, it was just like, he thought that the source wasn't good enough for us, so the whole place burst out laughing, and he just didn't get it. In other words, the pshat is that even though he was such an incredible gadol b'torah, it didn't occur to him that people would look at him or view him in that way. And that brings us to the next mitzvah. He was, as I mentioned last time, a real brisker, which means that, you know, like, any shita in the Rishonim, he would try to cover the cover it, because that's the sheet of brisk. The sheet of brisk is that if there's a sheet in the rishonim like that, you try to cover it. So for dalet minimon sukkis, for the lulav and esrog, etc., he wasn't samech on his own. I'm sure he had his own for nanon, but he was samech on someone else that he knew had 100% kosher dalet minim, and he would use that person dalet minim. So his son Avrami said over Ramai, said that one particular year, the person that they were going to use the dalet minim was in Ezra's Torah. You guys know where Ezra's Torah is in Yerushalayim? You know where Ulamei Beit Yisrael is?
Basically, he used to not buy his own.
He would, I'm sure he would buy his own, but for the bracha, he would be sent up from someone else's. Because there was someone, I guess, who, you know, went all out to, you know, mamish get something which is kosher, l'chol ha'deis, etc. So Avrami said, his youngest son Avrami said, that one year, they woke up on the first day of Yontif, on Sukkos, at 3:30 in the morning. They woke up at 3:30 in the morning, so they could walk all the way. I assume they wanted to make it to Ezra's Torah for Nates. And, you know, and that's what they did. And on the way back, Rav Torsky said to his son, "Do you think that because of what we did, we're better than anyone else?" And he said, "You should know." And at his time, at that time, his son was like 10, or actually, I don't know, maybe he was a teenager already, I'm not sure. He didn't say how old he was. But kitzer, so he said that, you know, "Do you think that we're better than anyone else because of what we did?" He said, "Avada not." He said, "We're not better than anyone else." He said, "We did what we did because that's what we understood is necessary for us to do. But it doesn't make us better than anyone else." So this was typical, you know, this was the way he was. The way he was is that he would literally have tremendous mysterious nefesh for learning Torah, tremendous mysterious nefesh for keeping mitzvahs, but at the same time, I'm not better than anyone else. I'm not better than anyone else. Did I tell you guys the story about the glasses on Hanukkah?
Yeah.
I told you that story? Right, well, not all of you were here, so I'll repeat it. On Hanukkah, his Rebbetzin said that he would light in many, many places, and he would use glasses instead of like what we use a Hanukkiah, he would use separate glasses and fill it with oil, and he used a lot of oil, etc. Kitzer, so by the end of Hanukkah, because he lit in so many different places, he had like 150 of these glasses. So his wife said, you know, the Ozeret could clean him for you on Sunday. He's like, "Chas v'shalom, I'll do it myself," because he viewed it, Mamish, as like the avoda of the kohen. But there's also a midah of anibus, you know, that no, I don't need anybody to do it for me. Did I tell you the spoon story? No, okay. So now a new story. Is Rebbetzin told me, and I think she mentioned this to a lot of people also, that very recently he was sitting at the table and his married daughters were there. And obviously she was there. I don't know, maybe a few of his sons were there also. And he like started looking around the table as if like something is missing. So his Everton was like, "What? What is it? You're missing something?" He said, no, nothing, nothing. And like he started to get up to go to the kitchen to get something. She said, "What is it? What do you need?" He said, "I noticed that I don't have a spoon." So she said, "So fine, so let one of our daughters go get it for you. It's kibunam. You're giving them, it's an opportunity for them to do a mitzvah. Now, they don't even live at home anymore. How often do they have this opportunity?" So he said, no, I'll get it myself. So she said, "No, it's a mitzvah kibunam. How could you take it away from them? This mitzvah kibunam." So he said, "Chas v'shalom that I should let anybody do anything for me, because I don't want to become lazy. And becoming lazy is the worst thing that can happen to a person." So she told me that in the end she won the argument, because she said she was very firm, and she said, "No, you have to let them do it, it's a mitzvah kibarav." And in the end he gave in. Now I was thinking to myself that it could be that in the end the reason why he gave in was just off shalom bias, or maybe because Chazal say you have to be mechabed your wife more than yourself. So if she was insisting, so fine, so he gave in. But I mean, most of us, I don't know, certainly, I would imagine most people have no qualms letting their kids do things for them. You know, you do so many things for your children. You know, there's no problem. As a matter of fact, there's even a story about the Brisker Rav that one time he was sitting with the Shach, and his daughter, the Brisker Rav's daughter, brought in a tea, and she had the cup with the hot water, the tea bag, the spoon, and then like a little thing of sugar. So she goes out of the room. And like a few seconds later, the Brisker Rav calls her back in, and he says, "Could you please put the tea bag into the water for me?" So she does. She leaves the room. A few moments later, he calls her back in, and he says to her, "Could you please pour the sugar into the tea for me?" So she does. And a few moments later, she leaves. A few moments later, he calls her back in, He says, could you please stir it for me? And she does. At that point, Rav Shach was like, Rebbe, I really don't understand. Why are you being matriarch here so much? So the Rav looked at, the Biskir Rav looked at Rav Shach and he said, a tircha? Fosfar a tircha? Since when is kibud av a tircha? I'm being mezakeh her. Every single time she comes back, I'm giving her another schos of kibud av. Now, the Biskir Rav meant it like that. That he meant it like that. But most people would be like, yeah, it's okay, yeah, you can go do this for me, go do this for me, do this job in the house and do this for me. You know, but I mean, it's like, you know, musagim that, which, we're not used to such musagim. I don't want my daughter to go get a spoon for me, you know. And she was describing also to me how when her parents, who are both no longer living, needed her help. So he would always say to her, yeah, go, 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 help your parents, you know, and he would be left alone at home and have to deal with the kids and have to, you have to understand, he was a phenomenal Muslim, right? But he would say to her, no, go, Abadi, you should go to your parents. And by the way, a woman, Me'ikar Adin, is pater from Kibud Abayim. I mean, Be'etzim, she has a chiyuv Kibud Abayim.
After she gets married.
Right, after she gets married, that's what I meant. A woman, you're right, I meant when she gets married, Be'etzim, a woman is pater. Why? Because she's Meshuvah to her husband. Her first responsibility to her husband. And the Chosleis, he would always tell her, no, go, go, take care of them. Sometimes she would go to America to take care of them, right? Actually, I remember one time, I don't know if she was in America for that reason, but I remember one time we were eating by him when his wife was not there, and somehow it came up that he lit the Shabbos candles. So I said to him, wait a minute, but Chazal say that the Shabbos candles is the mitzvah of the women. Right, because they take care of the house, and also because it says that Chava, you know, she doused the light of the world. The Adam was referred to as the Neiroi Shal Oilam, and she was Mechaba Neiroi Shal Oilam, so she has this mitzvah to make a tikkun, right, etc. So I said to him, so if your wife's not here, so shouldn't you give it to your daughters? So he looks at me as if like I'm crazy, and he says, I almost never get an opportunity to do this mitzvah, and you want me to give it up? I mean, every single mitzvah was precious, was a chavivus. It wasn't like, okay, fine, I have to do a mitzvah. Oh, here's another very, very good one. He had a shita, at least during the tekufa that I was learning by him, that yeshiva bachim shouldn't pay any attention to what science says. Shouldn't pay any attention to what science says. Why not? Why not? Because in his words, they're wallowing in the mud. We have Tiras Emes and they're wallowing in the mud. There was a certain book that I was asking him about, and he was like very, very against it. So it seemed a little bit, it hit me as being a little bit extreme. So I spoke to another Rebbe of mine, Yibam Ruchayim, and he told me the following. He said, in my opinion, I don't think it's usher to read such a book. You know, and he even told me that depending on your situation, it could be that it's a good idea to read such a book. And he explained to me, he said, I want to explain to you why it is that someone like Rav Tursky would speak in such a way. By the way, he was in Harvard for a time. I don't think he stayed till the end, but he was in Harvard for a time. It wasn't like he was ignorant of secular studies. As a matter of fact, one time when we were in Shir, and we were talking about if you have a triangle that has a right angle. You guys know what a right angle means? Meaning it's perfectly square on this side and it goes like this. So if you know the length of this, what?
Yishal Zavit, I think you call it.
Okay, Yishal Zavit. Okay, so it's called a right angle triangle. So if you know, you with me? If you know the length of the two sides of the 90 degree angle, then how do you, what?
Pythagoras. Call it
Pythagorean theorem.
Yeah.
Okay. No, it's A squared plus B squared equals C squared. But why do I remember that? I do not remember that from when I was in high school. I only remember it because it came up in the sugya that we were learning. So, okay, I don't remember what we were learning. So he, like, kind of like under his breath said, no, does anybody know how to figure this out? So, we all learned it when we were in high school, but none of us remembered it. So he said, this is not what I'm here for, but just so you should know, A squared plus B squared equals C squared. That's the formula. Okay? He knew a lot. He definitely knew a lot of secular studies information. But this is what he held. So my other Rebbe, Rav Lobianski, said to me like this. He knew him well. They lived together in Arzeh. They were neighbors in Arzeh Habira for a while. He said, when you're holding very deeply in Kabbalah, and then he looks at me with these like emphatic eyes, which he is. He would always deny it. Everybody knew that he was holding very, very deep in Kabbalah, but he would always deny it. As a matter of fact, it was a tchupa that I had a chavrusa shop with him once a week. We learned various things. Every now and then, like he would, I think we learned Rabbeinu Bachai Ala Torah. Every now and then, he would like look up and like, you know, say like very quickly something that was obviously Al Pi Kabbalah. And I would just like kind of look at him and be like, okay, I'm not sure what you want me to do with that. To this day, I'm not sure why he told me those things. Maybe he was testing the waters to see if I was holding by being able to get into it a little bit. But in any event, so Lopiansky says to me, when you're holding deeply in Kabbalah, which he is, so then the emes is so pure and so unadulterated and so absolute that anything which does not match up to that emes is just, it's like mag'il. It's abhorrent, you say in English.
Schmutz.
Yeah, it's schmutz. So he explained that to me. Now, so that's the first chelik of this ma'aser. Now, even books that were written, let's say, by frum people, and the point of the book, let's say, is to show through modern scientific discoveries to see the truth of the Torah. You know, like there's a lot of books like this, like you could see, you know, like for instance, they have, if you work out the cheshbon of the cycle of the moon, based on the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, I think it is, and you compare it, and you work it out like literally to the 15th decimal point, and you compare it to the most modern scientific information based on like the Hubble telescope or something like that, it's like so ridiculously close. And it's impossible to know such a thing, you know, if you don't have a Hubble telescope. So they, you know, like that's an example. You know, use that to prove the truth of the Torah, prove the Masoret Torah, something as an example like that. So he would say on occasion, it wasn't so often that it came up, but on occasion, he would say, you know, this is for people out on the street. This is not for yeshiva bachim, this is not for yeshiva, like they don't need it, we have Torah. We don't need it, we have the emes, we don't need this. So, that's the first half. Fast forward like maybe 4 or 5 years, and I bump into one of my friends, one of my old friends from Torah Simulation. And he still has a chavrusa together with Rav Tarski at that time. And he told me that they were learning the ksavim of, I think it was the altar of Slabatka, the altar of Nevardaka, the altar of Kelm, one of the altars, if I remember correctly. And he tells me like this, he says, we got up to a part where in the Sefer it said that the modern scientific discoveries that show, that prove the truth of the Torah, provides us with emunah b'chush. You guys have heard of the concept of emunah sikhlit and emunah chushit. Yeah, you've heard of such a thing? There's intellectual awareness of emunah, right? You know, it's a historical, a national historical fact that we were makabel Torah in Sinai. But then there's emunah chushit, where you mamish feel it. You know, it's like Yaakov Weinberg once said, a person could know that speeding is dangerous. But let's say if he was speeding, he was going, okay, for you guys, let's say 130 kilometers an hour, okay? And he gets into a terrible accident. And he's in the hospital for 9 months. And then after he gets out of the hospital, he's in rehab for 2 years. Now this guy really knows that speeding is dangerous. It's not the same type of knowledge. It's intellectual knowledge, and then there's something that you really know in your heart, like the pasuk says. So, in the Sefer it's saying that these modern scientific discoveries, they give us a munah b'chush. So my friend told me, his name is Chaim Rosen, he says to me that at that point, Rav Tursky kind of like muttered under his breath, I always thought that this was like for people on the streets. You know, it's not for, and that yeshiva people don't need this, and that it's a waste of time for them. And then he's like, goes quiet. And then he goes, ah, emunah b'chush, emunah b'chush. He had a certain way of talking. It was very, like, restrained enthusiasm. So when he told me this story, I was floored. My mamash was floored. Why? First of all, in general, nothing Rav Tursky ever said was just like, you know, like off the cuff. The man was holding in kol ha-Torah kulo. Kipshutai mamash. Kol ha-Torah. And not just holding. He knew kol ha-Torah kulo kipshutai mamash. So when he, you know, said numerous times over the course of the years that these things, you know, are for the people outside. He wasn't just Stam saying it. It was a very strong shita that he had that was neveya, that came from his understanding of what Torah is, what a yid is, how we're supposed to relate to Torah. So when my friend Chaim Rosen told me that mamish teich kedei kama shniot, he was chayzer boy, I was floored. Now you have to understand, if it would have been me, let's just say, if let's say I would have had a shita and I would come across, you know, let's say, a ksavim of the altar, so my first netiyah would be, okay, maybe he's talking about this, that, or the other. He's not talking in general. He's not talking about our books nowadays. He's talking about, you know, maybe certain things that certain people wrote back then. Or, I don't know if any of you are familiar with the history of what was going on in between World War I and World War II, but the Iker Nisayim between the two world wars was the Nisayim of Kfira. That was the Iker Nisayim. And it was so strong, all the Kfira that existed then, that it was mashpi on Bachrim as well. Bachrim were mushpa from it. The Haskalah and all the different isms that existed and the Kfira that came along with them, it was mashpia. It had a hashpa on the Bachrim. So if I wanted to, you know, explain away such a thing, I would have such an easy time with it. Yeah, he said that because back then, you know, it was very important because the Bachrim were mushpa from all of the ruchot of Kfira that were going around. I'm saying, or if you're someone who knows Kala Tarakula, you're a Gadol B'Torah, you know it, La Rachba, La Amka, say this, so you could say, fine, it's Sarachim Gadol. You've never heard a Talmud Chacham say such a thing? He comes across something in an Achron and he says, you know, this doesn't make so much sense, I don't know, Sarachim Gadol. You know, but the Pshadi is like this, you never heard such a thing. You never heard such a thing, whether it's in learning up the Sugyo, whether it's in Halacha, whether it's in Emunas V'Deis. So what's the Pshat? I think the Pshat is like the same you say. First of all, his Midas Ha'emes, and second of all, his Midas Avanimus. His Midas Ha'emes will not let him just, you know, like say a silly way of explaining it up. Not a silly way, but like, you know, a dachuk way to explain it away. You know, let's just figure out something to explain. And also, he had a Nibus. He was Mamish Mavatal himself to the Gedolei Torah, past and present. As a matter of fact, there were numerous times, for sure at least twice, where I asked him a certain question, and he says to me, this is a very, like something like, this is a very difficult question, you need to get Das Torah. Well, that's why I was asking him. I'm serious. And he wouldn't answer the question. He would say, he would tell me, you know, go to a Gadol B'Torah, don't ask me. Well, we all consider him a Gadol B'Torah. And if you speak to anybody now who's speaking and being mastered about him, everybody considers him a Gadol B'Torah. He's a phenomenal Gadol B'Torah. As a matter of fact, his brother-in-law, Avram Ornstein, they had a kenes at Teres Maisha on Monday night when the Shiva finished. You were there? You heard about it. So they had a kenes there, and Avram Ornstein, he spoke. He also spoke by the Keter and Amish after they buried him. And he said that he has a letter from Rav Tversky's Rebbe in Kabbalah. There was like a chabura of very big Talmidei Chachamim that would go to Rav Yisrael Elia Weintraub in Bnei Brak. He was American, but he came to Eretz Yisrael. So they would go to him to learn Kabbalah. This was his Rebbe in Kabbalah. So there was a tekufa for, I think, one El or two Els, where he asked his wife, if his wife doesn't mind, if he goes to Manchester to learn by Rabbi Yehuda Zev Segal, who was a very, very big tzaddik. He was the Rosh Yeshiva of the Manchester Yeshiva. So his wife gave him permission. I remember one time he thanked her Barabim for giving him permission to go away for a whole Elul and I think in Yom Kippur, 40 days. So there was a guy who apparently wrote a letter to Rabbi Yisrael Elia Weintraub, and he happened to mention in the letter that he's going to be learning with the Savreich. At the time, Rav Tversky was, I think, 30, 35. Okay? My age. Okay? So he wrote a letter to Elia Weintraub, and he mentioned, like, Derech Agav, for Elul's money, he's going to be learning with the Savreich, whose name is Moshe Tversky. So Rav Elia Weintraub wrote back to him, and he said, let me tell you something. And Rav Ornstein, when he read the letter, he had the physical letter, and he said that at first the family didn't even want to let him read the letter, even though Rav Tversky was already dead. This is that is pagan. He said, but I told him we have to read this letter. So he read the letter, and Rav Weintraub basically said that you should know, you have no idea what incredible luck you have that you get to learn with this person. This Avreich, Rav Moshe Tversky, is going to be one of the next Gedolei Hador, and you should just mamish hang on to him and get everything you can from him, because he is miyuchad b'minay. I mean, just like l'shones muflagos. He called him the Arisha b'chaburo. And b'chol zeis, clapping himself. The way he viewed himself was, you want the austerity, you have to go ask someone else. I'm no better than anybody else. You know, that's the way he was. Rabbi Meisel in the Rosh Hashiva of Teres Moshe said something at the Levaya that to me was one of the best, the best ways of touching up the godless of this person in Moshe Tversky. He said many people, most people, have many audiences in their life. You know what an audience is? An audience is like when you're performing on stage, let's say you have an audience, right? Most people have many audiences in their life. Meaning when they do things, they're doing it for their parents, for their wife, for their kids, for their talmidim, for their kihila, for other people. Meaning they want recognition. They want kavod. He said, Rav Moshe Tversky had one audience in his life. His one audience in his life was the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's it. And I can be made that it's be'emes like that. Because he was a brisker, so he had so many chumras and so many anhagas, and also because of his tremendous dveikus and his serious nefesh, he had so many things that he would do. And Bacham like always wanted to like find out like what is he doing and why is he doing and what's the reason for it. And he mamish did not like it. He did not like it. I think Rav Ernstein was the one who said over that many people who have lots of chumras, they want people to know about their chumras. But by him it was the exact opposite. He was introverted. He did not even appreciate it. As a matter of fact, I read a story that there was one guy who once asked him, he put the sefer, when they were done learning, he put it back and he didn't push it all the way in. And it was like a few svarim. So he could tell that he did it on purpose. It wasn't just like punked, you know, one book that he didn't push all the way in. So he said, Rebbe, why did you not push the svarim all the way back in? So he says to him, you want a piece of kugel? Said, come on, Rebbe, please, you'll save me time if you'll just tell me. I won't have to look it up. You want some challenge? So, what's pshat in those words? I don't think the pshat is that he thought that whatever the reason was, that this Talmud wasn't, you know, holding by being able to understand it. I think it was his way of saying, bug off. But in a nice way. Meaning, he would never say to someone, you know, could you leave me alone? Because he could not bring himself to that. As a matter of fact, someone told me that there was a certain guy who was in Teres Moshe for like 10 years, or like, I don't know, whatever it was, and you know, that he was the type of person that was mamish, like always questioning, like always asking questions and questions, and all the other Rebbeim, it was too much for them. They couldn't, it was just too much. So he was by Rav Tversky for like most of those 10 years because of Tversky. Seder, ask. Sometimes he'll, you know, he won't answer you if you're doing what to him is invading his privacy. But he's not going to be like, you're invading my privacy, please don't ask such a question. He just couldn't bring himself to say such a thing. And it wasn't natural for him like that. His brother, by the Leviah, said that naturally he was tough and shy. He was tough, and I think I could also tell. But he worked on himself. He worked on himself very hard. And from working on himself, he got to a point where he couldn't say to somebody, no, please don't ask me such a question. All right. I'd like to finish off with two like points of chizuk, maybe. You know, when a tragedy like this happens, you know, where it happened, to who it happened, when it happened, a lot of us have questions in our mind. Like, how could it be? Like, how could Hashem let such a thing happen? You know, and I would like to say for the record, I don't think there's anything wrong with having those questions. Yirmiyahu HaNavi has a sefer called Eicha. Eicha means how. The whole book is one big question. How could this happen? What?
How, not why.
Say either why, because you realize that most people is not like, why did this happen? How could this happen? How could Hashem? What a hell mean? Hell means how? Hashem, how could you let this happen? Right?
Yeah, but we saw the 10 Hebrew Gemalos were killed. Hashem said that the last one more time, the leader worked them up.
In Achinam? You're right. So there's a whole vart to explain what that means. So I'll say it very bekitzer. They say it over B'Shem Negra. I heard this numerous times. That the Gra says, Mashalama Adavar Daimah, maybe it's based on a medrash, I don't remember. He said, Mashalama Adavar Daimah. The top tailor, the most best tailor in the whole world was brought in to sew a beautiful garment for the king, and they gave him exactly, the chveis was 4 meters of material, and this material was like crazy expensive. And I told him you have to use every single last drop of material. So fine, so he did, and he made the garment. So then the king says to him, or no, there were ministers that were very jealous because now the king was like giving him so much covet. So they started making hashmatzot about him. They said, you know, by the way, he cut off some of the material and he pilfered it and he sold it on the black market. And you know, he really was hoodwinking you. So the king said, called him in and he said, you know, they're saying these things about you. How could we prove them wrong? He said, listen, there's only one way to prove them wrong. I'll take apart the whole garment. I'll unsew the whole thing. I'll roll out all the material and you'll measure it. And then you'll see that Taka, I used every single last bit. So that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu was saying to the Malachim. Hashem was saying, you want to see that it all makes sense? I'll have to unravel the whole Bria for you. The only way that you'll be able to, you've heard this before, right?
No, it's nice.
Yeah, the only way that you'll be able to understand is if I unravel the whole Bria for you, I'll take apart the whole Bria and I'll show you how everything fits. So that's the part. But the whole Yirmiyah, the whole Sefer Eicha is one big question. Hashem, how could this happen? How could it be that Yerushalayim that was on the top of the world now is a dump? Is a churban? Okay, listen, I don't think it's bad. The question is then, where do the questions lead you? That's the thing. So I remember after the World Trade Center, and you guys are really young when this happened, but you've heard of it, right? At the World Trade Center, those two humongous buildings in New York were destroyed and like 3,000 people were killed, like that. So, what? 2000 or 2001? Right, 13 years ago. So you guys were like pretty young when that happened, right?
We all remember.
Okay.
Like yesterday.
It was shockwaves. It sent shockwaves throughout the whole world and befraught by Yidden. So everybody was looking for, you know, some type of, you know, direction, inspiration, you know, answers, something. So I went to my Rebbe Yerav Tarski and I said, Rebbe, how are we supposed to react to such a thing? Like, what are we supposed to do? So you know what he said to me? Talk to Hashem. So I gave him this like curious look and he said, you probably don't know what I mean. He said, I don't mean during Shemona Esrei. He said, I just mean talk to Hashem. Just talk to Him. No. It was very, very brief what he said. It was very short and to the point. But the truth is that this Nakuda hits on like one of the deepest chords of the Neshama. Because what's the pshat? We know in our seichel that Kol Ma'ad Avad Rachmanu L'Tav Avad. We know up here intellectually that everything that HaKadosh Baruch Hu does, yes, we know that you're so much smarter than us and that you've got your cheshbonis. But that's like, okay, it's like way up there. That awareness is way up there. But when you know, if your husband or father or Rebbe or neighbor or son-in-law's uncle or whoever it was, or just someone that you read about, who you see was a tzaddik, was just murdered in such a violent, you know, cold-blooded manner. So your reality is not your intellectual awareness, you know, of that, okay, everything Hashem does is ultimately for the good. Seder, I know that. Your reality is your emotional pain. And the emotional pain is not rational. Your emotions are just not rational. So how do you deal with that? So what you need to know, what we need to know, is that even when things are rough and terrible, Hashem is still with us. Kibyachal, He's still holding our hand. He's still, you know, there with us. So how do you get to there? How do you do that? So I think that's what he meant. I think you talk to Hashem. You talk to Him. You tell HaKadosh Baruch Hu how it feels. If you're in pain, you say, Hashem, I'm in pain. This hurts. You talk to Him the same way that you would talk to your friend. If let's say you're in pain, you want to if you would want to talk to your friend, you would want to talk to your neighbor, to your mother, to your sister, to your wife, to your child, whoever it is. The same way that if you would be in pain, you would, just by talking to someone else, it helps. You feel like someone's with you. They empathize with you. They listen to you. Talk to Hashem. Talk to Him. Tell Him what it feels like in your own words. Not when you're done with Shemoneh Esrei. In your own language, whatever language you're comfortable with. Talk to Him. And tell Him, say, Hashem, I feel like you're abandoning us. If you feel like HaKadosh Baruch Hu is abandoning, so say, Hashem, this feels like you're abandoning us. I can't deal with this. You gotta help me out. That's one nekuda that I wanted to mention. Another nekuda is on a personal level, but I think there's a very important lesson to learn out of here, is that one of the things that was, for me, you know, maybe this is a little bit selfish, but what can I do? You know, the emotional reality is what it is. One of the things for me that was extremely difficult by the fact that my Rebbe was murdered is that after I left Taras Moshe, basically for the past 10 plus years, I didn't really keep up a shayches with him. And I always had, like, in the back of my head, you know, I should go to him, you know, to visit him on Yom Tov or on Purim or on Hanukkah and talk to him in learning. I could still gain so much from him, you know, but especially when you're married and you have kids, life is very busy. Even when you're single, you know, if you're studying to get a profession or you're in yeshiva, even when you're single, a lot of times life is very busy. But once you're married and you have kids, life is very, very busy. You know, and sometimes you just don't get to it. Well, now it's too late. Now I can't. And now I'm beating myself up inside and thinking to myself, wow, that was really stupid. You know, I have a friend who's in the mirror. He's married, he has kids, but he kept up his once a week chavrusa with Rav Toresky up until the Sunday before he died. Up until the Sunday of the week that he died, every single week he kept up the shaykhus. And I mamish, I had such jealousy for him. I was so jealous that he kept it up. So incredibly jealous. Not like that I begrudge the fact that he did it, but feeling so stupid that I didn't keep up a shaykhus. Never went to see him. Not on Yom Tov, not on Hanukkah, not on Purim. It tears me up inside. So what did it show to me? What do I hope that I'm going to learn from there? You have to make priorities. Priorities. What do I mean by that? I don't know if you guys are living at home, not living at home. I'm not living at home. Haven't been living at home, meaning when I say at home, I mean my father's house. The home that I grew up in. I have my own home, Baruch Hashem. So how often do you talk to your father? You want to have a relationship with your father? You have to think to yourself for a moment. If Chalil of the Chaz, my enemy's father, to speak Balash and Saginar, if Chalil of the Chaz, my enemy's father, would die tomorrow, would I regret the fact that I didn't call him more often? If Chalil of the Chaz, my enemy's friend from yeshiva, would die tomorrow, would I regret that I didn't call him more often? Or whoever it is, all the relationships that we have in our life, or things, or even not relationships, things that we always think to ourselves, you know, I really want to get to that. We have to think to ourselves, what if all of a sudden it becomes impossible to do it? Let's say, you take for example, I've never gone to Rav Aaron Liebsteinman to get a bracha. And you always think to yourself, you know, I really love to go to get a bracha from him. Well, he's only getting older. He's not getting younger. Right? So, are you going to kick yourself in the pants one day and say, oh, I can't believe I didn't do it. Now, something like that, it could be that you're not going to really beat yourself up over. But there are things in our life. You know, there's a story Rabbi Pesach Kron, in one of Rabbi Pesach Kron's books. You know, one of these families that had a bungalow up in the Catskills. So a lot of people, the husband is in the city and works during the week, and then he comes up for Shabbos. So his wife, like, called him and texted him and emailed him numerous times, bring checkbooks. So, you know, he made sure to, you know, set it aside and whatever, you know, so, and he brought the checkbooks, you know, and he saw that she didn't put it away. She was like a little bit of a disorganized person. She didn't put it away. She like just hung it, you know, on the pole which was sticking up from the baby carriage. And like it bothered him because, you know, she made such a big deal that he should bring it up, and you know, and then she just left it there. And the next week when he comes back, he sees that it's still there. And he feels like telling her, you know, like, what's wrong with you? You're so disorganized. But he decided, you know what, Shalom Bais, forget it. Just leave it. He goes back to the city. The next day he gets a call that his wife died from a heart attack. So his wife had a thing that whenever something would bother him, because he was like an organized type of person, and she wasn't, she would always say, Zevo Chashuv, Zevo Chashuv. So after she died, he took that bag of checks and he like hung it somewhere in his house and he put a big sign on it that said Zelo Chashuv. And he felt very good, although obviously he was grieving that his wife died, but he felt very good that he didn't make a big deal about these checks. What's the point? The point is that sometimes it happens in life that, I mean, listen, we don't hope that people are going to die, but we have to realize it can happen. Let's talk about an example where someone doesn't die. This is very morbid to talk about people dying all the time. I read a story about an older couple. They're in their 50s. All the children are married and out of the house. No, 60s. I'm sorry, they're in the 60s. And the husband just retired. His whole life he was a workaholic. He came out, never, you know, spent time with his wife and kids. Now that he's out of work because he's retired, so he's bored like crazy and he wants to, you know, spend time with his wife. Well, she didn't want. She didn't want. For 40 years, she built a whole life for herself. Basically, she didn't really have a relationship with her husband. She didn't want to get divorced because she decided there's no point. But she didn't want. And she said to him, oh, now all of a sudden you have nothing to do, so you want a relationship with me. Sorry, buddy, I'm not interested. So there's an example where someone didn't die. But you know what? It might be too late. Maybe they could go to therapy. Maybe he can work on it. But with Pashtus, you're too late. For 40 years, you could have established a relationship with your wife. Now you woke up all of a sudden. Why? Because now you have no other choice. This is something I think, you know, we need to take out and realize that life is short. And we have to decide what are priorities for us, that we just need to do it. We can't push it off. It has to be done. I know I'm going over time, but I want to give one more example. Okay, and with this I'll finish. Imagine a guy whose marriage is on the brink of total destruction. Or he's got a kid who's going off the derech. 99% of people, if necessary, would stop everything they're doing in life, if that's what would be necessary, and focus on saving their marriage or saving their kid. Correct? You know, let's say you have a guy, he's a masman in Kail, right? You know, and he never spent any time with his kid. But if his kid goes off the derech and they start telling him, listen, you have to spend time with me, you have to take him out to peace, you have to schmooze with him, you have to bring him to basketball, play with him, man. And they tell him, you know, your kid is so far off, you so didn't put anything, you're going to have to spend all your time with him, you're going to cannot have no time to learn. How many people would say, I guess my kid will just have to be fried for the rest of his life. No! There's priorities in life. Chacham. If it's a priority, why'd you wait till it went sour? Why did you wait till a disaster happened to realize that it was a priority? If it was a priority, then you should have been mashkia in it all along. And this is an important thing, I think, that we have to take out of here, to realize what our priorities are and really to make them priorities. Sure.